Matt Sullivan here to remind you to stop putting screens on your gutters. Better to schedule a free estimate with the local experts at Gutter Helmet so you stay off the ladder. Visit gutterhelmetindy.com. With Gutter Helmet, you'll never clean your gutters again. gutterhelmetindy.com.
Hammer and Nigel.
Can you believe these characters are weirdos?
So let's rock it!
All right, Hammer, one word. I'm giving you one word to describe last night's final GOP gubernatorial debate. One word.
Feces.
Well, feces is a noun. I was hoping more for an adjective. Or
You're asking too much for whatever that was I watched last night. That was so uncomfortable, so cringy, and really, it wasn't because of the candidates. The moderator thought this was his audition. He thought it was an audition for like a talk radio show. He was trying to be Mr. Hot Take Guy all through the night.
Okay, so the story is old Johnny Boy then,
yes.
Right?
John Schwantes, he's the...
Who?
Host of Indiana Lawmakers on PBS.
Oh, yeah, I DVR it every weekend.
He wanted this to be about him. Now, if I could put this into a way I think a lot of people could understand. If you've ever watched a Big Ten basketball game and seen old TV Ted Hightower, make the game all about himself, or maybe you've watched a Major League Baseball game where Angel Hernandez is so awful at his job, he makes it about himself. That's what happened last night. You had somebody that thought they were cute, somebody that thought they were a hot take machine, and they weren't. And it was uncomfortable. Now, the front runner wasn't even there. Mike Braun was in D.C. He was voting against the big foreign aid package, the Ukraine money, etc. He voted no on that. Todd Young voted yes. We can talk about that later. But the front runner wasn't there. So already the debate loses a little steam. But then they trot out this guy. And my goodness, the way he handled things, Nige, it looked like we had a contest and we had caller number 9 moderated debate.
Probably would have been better.
It would have been better. There's no doubt in my mind. So here's a little bit, if you missed it last night. Listen to this. The question is, do you think the presidential election was stolen in 2020? Now, mind you, this is an Indiana gubernatorial debate.
A primary debate.
And the question was, do you think the 2020 election was stolen? You're going to hear the moderator. You'll hear a few candidates. But listen how smug and how much of a smartass this guy is.
A significant number of Republicans in Indiana, certainly, and elsewhere, agree with President Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen. Raise your hand if you agree that the election was stolen.
That question cannot be answered yes or no.
That is
not a yes or no question.
That's funny because I asked it as a yes or no question.
Oh! Well,
it involves facts.
Yes, do you? Let me reframe it, Counselor. Counselor, is Joe Biden the duly elected president of the United States?
Yes.
All right. Anybody disagree? Very good.
Wait, I just want to make a statement because I just think that's an unfair question. Let's just be very clear. What happened in the 2020 election that everybody should agree on is that it wasn't properly adjudicated. So they should have spent more time investigating that election, and it wasn't it was not investigated.
Next question.
So that's an unfair question.
Oh.
I think we know where you come down. No, listen.
That was Rittenhour, right?
Yeah.
Hill and Rittenhour going after the moderator.
But why are we talking about Joe Biden in 2020 in a 2024 state primary debate? It's a ridiculous, absurd question from a guy who clearly wanted to make a name for himself last night. And you heard Jamie Rittenhour there. Curtis Hill, he had a scowl on his face last night. I was surprised Curtis Hill didn't walk across the stage and confront this guy. He had an issue with some of the election security questions.
I went to bed at 2:00 in the morning with President Trump winning, and woke up in the morning and he was losing. There are anomalies that we can't understand, we don't know about, so we cannot answer.
I'll just say for a question that's impossible to answer, you just answered it. So next try again. Raise your hand. Well, you did.
See, he's always got to get the last word in.
This guy's a prick.
Right.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I wouldn't recognize him on the street. I've never watched his horrible PBS show. I could just tell you it's horrible just by his demeanor.
How about another question about the presidential election here in an Indiana primary debate for the governor candidates?
Raise your hand if you will recognize the results of the November election for president, regardless of the outcome. Raise your hand if you will recognize the outcome of the presidential election in November.
We're not going to. You're asking us to say something that hasn't even happened yet. We plan on governing the state of Indiana. We would like to base that on facts.
Senator Braun, who again is not here this evening, received Donald Trump's endorsement for the governor. How many of you would have welcomed President Trump's endorsement?
Why wouldn't we? Maybe that's a better question.
Yeah, I'm not here to tell you whether you should or shouldn't. I'm just asking you the question. You all would have
welcomed. It seems like you're really trying to set us up and cause division in our party, and we don't appreciate it.
Ms. Rittenhour, I think the party is doing quite capably on its own, creating some division.
See, he's got to get the last word in. He's got to be Mr. Funny Guy, Mr. Zinger.
He's incredibly partisan. Here, hey, John, here, I'll raise my hand. And it's got one finger on it.
And listen, we can sit here and keep ripping on John Schwantes here, and we've got more audio to play. But this ultimately falls on the debate commission. If you're the Indiana Republican Party, why on God's green earth would you want a PBS guy moderating a debate on PBS? Why would you want that as a Republican? This is the same kind of thing that Vivek Ramaswamy was ticked off about on that NBC debate. You know, as Republicans, again, this isn't a general. This was a Republican primary. Why are we on a network where everybody hates us? And it's clear that that guy hated everybody that was up there. Here's another hypothetical question that was brought forth last night.
Yes or no, all of you who would have voted for the CHIPS Act, raise your hand. So we have, for those listening, we have Mr. Chambers, Mr. Doden, and those who would have voted against. We have Ms. Rittenhour, and we have Mr. Hill, Ms. Crouch. Did you raise your hand one way or the other?
You know, I would vote against it based upon what I know. But, you know, I was talking about hypothetical questions. Not sure that's what we're here to discuss.
Well, there's not much hypothetical, though, about the notion of plants that are opening in a high-tech sector, which many states across the country are benefiting.
I just had a question on that.
No, we're not going to have questions at this point. Sorry. No, I asked the questions. Sorry.
I would have been like,
remember, I said I'd be kind and gentle. Don't push me.
Oh, look out, everybody.
Watch out, the PBS guy.
We got a badass over here at PBS. Keep talking. He might have a fundraiser on the air. Look out.
Tell me there was questions of substance. Anything about taxes or anything like that?
So I got a few clips here, and we'll wrap up the segment with this, because I do think this was pretty much the only important part of this debacle last night. The subject of property tax came up. So I'll play a little bit of every candidate that was there last night. Again, Mike Braun was voting in D.C. He's the front runner, according to polls. He wasn't there.
I think that was to his advantage that he didn't show up.
He won last night by not being there. Here's Jamie Rittenhour on property tax.
On May 8th, my intention is to go to all 92 counties to talk to the county commissioners and to have a real conversation about lowering your property taxes. What we know is that right now there are a lot of referendums that are coming from the schools. We love our schools. We want to support our teachers. We want our teachers to get paid well. But we are growing and expanding our schools at a rate that is not able to be kept up by the property tax owner. So right now what we need to do is we need to have a conversation at the county level.
Okay, that was Jamie Rittenhour. Same question, Brad Chambers.
I would look at the assessments. They're different from county to county. People don't understand them. So simplify the assessment process and make them uniform across the state to the extent we can do that. Create consistency and understanding for people and create some opportunities for seniors not to get kicked out of their house and have portability of the built-in gains they have.
Property tax, same question, Curtis Hill.
Property tax is certainly a concern by a lot of people, but depending on where you go, so are income taxes and so are sales tax. We need to have a comprehensive approach. Yeah. This isn't a gimmick. It's not a solution, a quick fix. We need to have a long-term plan for how to move forward. The problem is with the assessed values. The assessed values in every community are different. We need to work a strategy where the state works with the locals to come up with a good program so that we can manage our property taxes in an efficient, fair way, particularly as it pertains to young people and seniors.
Property tax candidate Eric Doden.
We're proposing that we'd freeze it for seniors, but we'd also, basically the growth would only be allowed to be about 5% a year under our plan, which makes it easier for people and their budgets to plan. So that is the foundation of our plan for how we help people with property tax issue that's raging right now across the state.
At least they're talking about it.
Right.
For a long time, they wouldn't even mention it.
And lastly, Suzanne Crouch.
You know, as a state representative, I voted for the largest property tax cut in our state's history, and I'm certainly open to that. And my opponents are entitled to their own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And as a state representative, I cut taxes a dozen times, and that's why I want to continue to cut taxes and eliminate the state income tax, putting money into your pockets, helping small businesses grow, attracting people to Indiana.
I'll listen to that.
So, again, watching that debate last night was like watching a college basketball game, a Big Ten game with TV Ted Valentine, or a Major League Baseball game with Angel Hernandez behind the plate.
Was Ted Valentine the coach or the ref that... It took Bob Knight like 5 minutes to get off the court after he's ejected, and Valentine's just standing there with his chin in his hand, and Bob Knight finally leaves the court and like walks right by him and brushes up against him, and the crowd was just going nuts at Assembly Hall.
Buzz the tower a little bit.
Yes, buzz the tower.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's him. Okay.
He loved him some him. He made every Big Ten game about himself.
Hammer and Nigel Show.
Hammer, I wasn't able to take in the Pacer game quite like you last night, or quite how I wanted to anyway. Just family stuff, kids running around, dinner, homework, all that stuff. But apparently, I was able to go in and out of the game, but apparently they turned it on last night.
125-108. Big Pacer win on the road last night in Milwaukee. Series now tied, one game apiece. They always say the playoff series doesn't really begin until the road team steals a game. Well, we got ourselves a playoff series, baby, and it was good. Pascal Siakam, 37 points for the Pacers. He becomes the first player since Reggie Miller to have back-to-back 30-point games in the playoffs. And Here he is last night talking about putting it on the Milwaukee Bucks.
You know, just I'm blessed, man. Blessed to be here. Didn't go to the playoff last year, so that was my goal coming in this year. I'm blessed to be able to be in this organization like the Pacers. You know, they're giving me everything. The love is amazing. So I feel good, man. We're in the playoffs. I'm back where I belong. So I just want to continue to compete.
Love it.
Man, he's been a machine, and he got some help last night. Miles Turner had 22, Haliburton had 12 assists, and Andrew Nembhard, 20 points. And I was watching this game, and it was kind of a slower start for the Pacers. The moment the momentum turned is when Andrew Nembhard, kind of this mild-mannered athletic guard, decided he wasn't going to put up with crap from anybody else for the rest of the night. He got up in the face of Bobby Portis.
I saw that.
Got up in the face of some other Bucks. Got a technical foul. Was pushing. Was talking some trash. That lit the fire, man. And after that, it was on. I did not have Andrew Nembhard lighting the fire on my bingo card heading into last night, but I'm glad he did it. That was the playoff intensity I think so many fans were waiting to see.
And let's hope we see it again Friday.
Friday, 5:30 tip-off.
Strange tip-off time.
Bizarre time. It's a little happy hour over at Cambridge Fieldhouse. 5:30 tip-off. And if you're going to that game, man, create it as a home court advantage. Make that place Thunderdome. Create hell, because it's been a while since the Fieldhouse has been rocking and rolling on a playoff game. This was the Pacers' first playoff win in 11 games. They were swept out of their two previous series. They lost the Game 7. They lost Game 1. They had lost their previous 10 straight playoff games, and now they're coming home. It's going to be an afternoon delight at the field house.
I think downtown's going to be crazy.
I do too, man. I think it's going
to
be bumping.
Even in the hours leading up to the game to tip off at 5:30, even I bet there's going to be a lot of people downtown that aren't going to the game that will be bellied up at a bar watching it somewhere.
And I miss that. I miss seeing that atmosphere here downtown. Tyrese Halliburton, after the game, was looking ahead to the atmosphere on Friday.
We're excited to go home, have our fans with us. We expect an unbelievable environment. An environment we haven't seen this whole playoffs, with the noise level and stuff. So we're excited to go home and be in front of such a great crowd.
Blow the roof off that thing if you're going on Friday. It's a gold out. I think everybody's getting a gold Pacers t-shirt in attendance. And have a good time. Update from the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indy 500. Race day parking at IMS and camping officially sold out for this year's Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Whoa, what about the shuttles?
Shuttles are still available.
Okay.
So you can buy those shuttle passes and leave from the airport or downtown.
Yeah.
From the airport. I love it.
Yeah, we did that last year. It was great.
It's so worth it.
It's worth the extra couple of bucks.
It is so stress-free. Like, you go through a lot of the barricades. They get you in. They get you out. You just chill. It's stress-free. I love the shuttle. But if you're looking to park yourself, you're going to have to find like a neighborhood where they're parking cars in lawns or something like that. Because all the parking at the Speedway, even the camping, is sold out. It's the Hammer and Nigel Show.
The Hammer and Nigel Show.
My name is Nigel. Jason Hammer right over there with a very special guest in studio.
Nicole Kiprilov is a political consultant, former press secretary for Elise Stefanik, has done a lot of stuff in New York. Nicole, welcome to Indy. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me.
So what brings you to Indy? Because I'm looking at your resume here, which is super impressive, but there's a lot of stuff about New York on there. And we can talk about that in just a little bit. But what brings you to Indy?
So I've been on a mission to flip New York for a few years now, and I didn't think that was a big enough task, so I came to Indy to try and flip Indianapolis as well. So we are here. I'm here to really look into some of the civic engagement that's happening in Indianapolis to figure out why, in a red state, you have a city as blue as Indianapolis and what we can do about it, right? So we're looking specifically at diversity outreach to the different communities here. What are some of the gaps in the infrastructure that the Republican Party is leaving behind? How do we go in, identify those gaps, and figure out how can we come up with solutions to that? And my understanding is there's already a lot of momentum here. So if we can take a look at the model that's being used for diversity outreach, conservative diversity outreach, and scale it, maybe replicate it on a national level, that would be a huge win.
Well, I mean, in the midterms, New York did flip from blue to red in certain districts and city council seats and house seats, right?
You know, we did well.
There's a few.
There were a few, but you know what? It wasn't enough. And I think from my perspective as someone who's really deep into politics and New York politics and government, and I've been doing it for a few years, I had a little bit of a different perspective because I could see how lacking our campaigns were, how lacking our candidates were. You know, we're not picking our best candidates. We don't have the campaign infrastructure, but the potential is there. The energy is there. New Yorkers are fed up, especially now with the migrant I call it the illegal immigrant crisis. It's not a migrant crisis. Yeah. It's the illegal immigrant crisis. New Yorkers are fed up. It doesn't matter who you are, what your political background is. Everyone wants a higher quality of life currently in New York City. So the momentum is there, the energy is there, but we are just not doing enough to harness it.
So when you've got the job that you've been tasked to do, take a city like Indianapolis and take it from a pretty blue city to eventually maybe spots of red, does that include having tough conversations with the folks that may be on your side, the Republican Party? Because so often here in Indy, it feels like the Indiana Republicans have decided to just mail in Indianapolis. Yeah. There's a lot of races where there's not even a candidate.
Oh, absolutely. It requires having those conversations. But, you know, these conversations can absolutely be very productive, because at the end of the day, it's all about our shared values, what we all care about, right? People who are, you know, the people of Indianapolis and the people in the who are leading the Republican Party, you know, they have a lot in common. They have kids who go to the same schools, who are dealing with CRT and SEL in those schools, right? So they care at the root. At the root, we care about the same things. And so I think those conversations can be very productive. I think, you know, I think moving the needle in a city like Indianapolis starts at the grassroots level. It's going to take time, but it's about uniting behind a strategy that can eventually work. And I think it's possible. It just requires cooperation from many different entities, and it requires a lot of hard work.
You talk about grassroots. We're starting from like the dirt and the seed right. In Indianapolis. There ain't no grassroots, because it's, you know, some of these elections, it's been like 60-40. Mayor Hogsett, for instance, liberal prosecutor, Ryan Mears, same deal.
Breakdown of Democrats to Republicans,
yes,
in a county.
Exactly.
So we've done a lot of that grassroots work actually in New York in some of the bluest electoral districts there, and it's honestly eye-opening. And no one really wants to hear about this because it's not glamorous work. No one wants to go out and do deep canvassing, but that's where it starts. You have to start. We don't have the luxury of jumping to, a more advanced level at this point. We have to start at the basics. And I could tell so many stories about this. I can tell you stories about spending hours in the bluest areas in New York talking to Democrats who are fed up with what's happening because they want a stop sign put up at the end of their street and their local city council representative isn't putting up a stop sign. They're concerned about their kids' safety when cars are driving by. But the reason they're not voting Republican is because they haven't gotten that outreach from the Republican Party, from Republican candidates. So that's the energy I'm talking about, right? Is it's there. The people are fed up. The people are on our side generally. But how do we talk to them? How do we harness that energy? That's really what it comes down to.
We're chatting with Nicole Kiprilov, political consultant, trying to figure out if there's any way possible Indianapolis could change its political landscape. Now, again, you came up through New York, and we were talking off the air. You were a communications representative for Elise Stefanik. What's that like? Because she's a name that's out there. She's one of those folks that could just put out a tweet that says, good morning, and 55 people respond with the middle finger emoji or something like that. She's one of those people that have aligned herself with Donald Trump. She's a well-known Republican. What's it like being in that spotlight?
Well, you know, it requires having thick skin, right? That goes without saying. I think at the point at which I was Elise Stefanik's press secretary, I had already, you know, gone through so much of the, you know, BS in New York politics. And I had been fighting the Democrats, the Republicans, pretty much everyone in New York. So I had built up that thick skin by the time I got to
her
office.
Did you ever fight the love gov, Andrew Cuomo? Did he ever have any harsh words for you?
I was working in the state Senate at the time for a prominent state senator. So, you know, I was doing his communication strategy. So, yeah, absolutely. We were fighting him as well. But there was, you know, at the time, there was also a bigger enemy, which was, you know, there was the forming of the leftist coalition, the radical leftist coalition in the state Senate. And I was fortunate enough to be in the state Senate when that coalition was forming, which was, you know, I say that sarcastically because it was obviously a horrible thing, but it was also good to see the formation of that and really try and destroy it at the beginning. So, that was definitely an interesting experience.
When you look at the news and see what's happening to New York right now, Mayor Adams, and you've got woke prosecutors, you've got this, you know, influx of, you know, illegal aliens. What do you think when you see what's happening to New York now?
I think now is finally the time for Republicans in New York to wake up and realize we need better campaign infrastructure. We need better candidates. We need candidates who are going to be America first, New Yorkers first, right? Putting New Yorkers first before the illegal immigrants, before everyone else. And we need to finally let go of our egos, let go of fulfilling our ego complexes, come together and realize that we have to put in the work. We don't have the luxury of doing all of this infighting. We don't have the luxury of going with and supporting mediocre candidates, misallocation of resources. It's this is all low-hanging fruit, honestly. I know it doesn't sound like it, but it's easy.
And it seems like a big problem, whether it's New York, Chicago, or even here in Indianapolis. You've got a group of people who say, the crime is out of control, I don't like what's going on, my property tax is high, and then they go to the ballot box and they vote for the same crap that they've been voting for time after time again.
Straight ticket
Democrat, because it's been, you know, just beat into their head, this is what I have to do.
So, you know, I do a lot of work. So I work for the America Fund now. It's the fastest growing conservative funding firm in the country. So I do a lot of work with combating wokeism in the military. And then another initiative I work on is public figure education and training, which includes candidate development. And so we did some focus groups to come up with some data for a new communication strategy for candidates and electeds. And part of the results of the focus group was that Black, Hispanic, and white voters all across the nation, swing voters, moderates, are actually at a point where the leftist messaging that has been working so far, so, you know, the George Floyd story, for example, and how George Floyd turned into a symbol for Black voters, that is really quickly starting to lose its efficacy. So this is the point from a communications perspective at which Republicans can step in. They can use some of the tactics that the left is using, right, which involves an emotional appeal to voters, telling different communities that they're being seen and they're being heard, but also not making the same mistakes as Democrats are making right now with this hackneyed approach to using race, for example, as a talking point in everything. It's getting old. Voters are getting tired of it. Now's our chance to come in.
Got about 30 seconds left here. You mentioned you're doing something with the military. What is that?
So we are. So wokeism in the military is a big problem, and that has, you know, many different components. One of which is we are replacing merit with race and gender quotas in the military, and we are working right now with a bunch of organizations. We're working with Congress to get our military back on track, because right now wokeism in the military is a national security crisis. No one is safe. We are not sending our best to the military.
Then you're below recruiting goals.
Oh, severely. And that is absolutely tied to wokeism in the military. No one wants to join anymore because of that.
Nicole Kiprilov, political consultant. Good luck in everything you're trying to do here in Indy. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. Would love to be back.
Did you know that you can buy your own flame-throwing robot dog?
I'm sorry, what?
You can buy your own flame-throwing robot dog. It's called the Therminator for around $10,000. I've always wanted a flamethrower. Doesn't Elon Musk have a flamethrower that he sells?
I think so, but you're telling me that not only can I get a flamethrower, I can get it attached to a robot dog?
Yes.
This is some Dr. Evil stuff.
Yeah. You know, I have one simple request, and that is to have sharks with frickin' laser beams attached to their heads.
I mean, it literally looks like a robot dog with a flamethrower installed on top of it. And they're legal in all 50 states.
Take my money. How much is this thing?
And they're not really kind of pushing, again, 10 grand.
Oh.
10 grand. They're kind of... Oh. It's not really a guard dog. They say it's for, like, controlled burns and ice and snow removal.
It's not going to be a guard dog. I've got a robot dog with a flamethrower, and I'm not supposed to use it on people? I don't think so.
Here's the commercial if you are indeed interested in the $10,000 flame-throwing robot dog.
How much is that dog in the window?
Yeah!
Therminator flamethrower robot dog with powerful destructive breath. Get yours today. Kevlar suit for petting not included.
I definitely want one.
And I'm totally using it on people. I'm sorry. You don't buy a $10,000 flame-throwing robot dog and just use it to burn leaves in the backyard.
That's what they said it's for. Clearing weeds, pest removal, snow removal, pyrotechnics and entertainment.
Rival removal. That's what we're using it for.
Right.
A couple of quick notes here. Check out the contest page at WIBC.com. Your chance to win the last tickets to our Tales from the Track event presented by Relay Indiana. We've got the booze being provided by Hotel Tango Distillery. The event is sold out Monday, May 20th, but you can win tickets. Check out the contest page. And right now, you can go to store.hammerandnigel.com. Check out some of the new merchandise. We've got Month of May shirts. We've got new patriotic shirts. Today, we're highlighting the 1776 shirt. It's a cool-looking shirt.
I like it.
It's got the stars around it, the Hammer and Nigel logo. Make your purchase today, store.hammerandnigel.com.
Hammer and Nigel.
Can you believe these characters are weirdos?
So let's rock it!
Jason Hammer right over there with a special in-studio guest.
Brian Martin is a retired police officer from here in central Indy. And he reached out to me on social media and said, we need to have a conversation about the mental well-being, the mental health of first responders and police officers.
Yes.
And we're going to do that right now. Brian, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
So, Brian, why did you reach out to me?
Well, I have a career of 16 years in law enforcement, and it wasn't the way I wanted it to go necessarily. I wanted to retire with at 52 and pension and never have to worry about everything ever again. But you have to have a plan B, and I got 16 years.
So why did you decide to end your time as a police officer?
That came kind of unexpected, I guess, to start out. Back in 2010, I had a pretty bad incident. I won't go into the details of it, but it was damaged me to the core. I took one day off work and back to work on.
So you responded to a call or a situation, and you arrived on the scene, and it was something
very traumatic,
horrific.
Yes, it was the worst thing I've ever seen. Nobody should see that ever. And I took one day off work and back to work Sunday, completely damaged. And over the years, never went to see anybody about it. Never went to get medication, zero treatment. Try to use alcohol to cope with it for a while, which works.
It's temporary.
Initially,
it's a temporary fix.
Band-aid, but it's not the right answer.
Right.
And as your career keeps going on, every day you go to work, you get more events. Your cup continues to fill up. And, back in 2018, I had a really bad flashback. And I wasn't even working this day. I had a really bad flashback because I saw this news article of an incident that happened in Carmel, threw me back into that first incident. And I got really suicidal, put a gun in my head, and wanted to end it.
So we hear about PTSD mainly when it comes to folks in the military, but with police officers and first responders, this is a very real thing as well.
Yeah, we see it every day, and it's part of the culture with same as veterans and in the military. We don't say anything. You know, we're too tough to say anything. We're afraid to say anything. I was afraid of being labeled as something, afraid of losing my job.
Were there protocols available? Were there things available at your department, at your disposal?
Early on, there wasn't a peer support team. We didn't have any resources. We can go out and probably try to find that, but I didn't know. I didn't have any of that training. I didn't know how to reach out to somebody to help myself.
Take us through your darkest moment. You mentioned you had a gun to your head. What went through your mind to lead you to that point? Did you think about your family? Did you think about your job? Or was this just something that was like a spur of the moment type of
deal?
And
then why did you put the gun down ultimately?
Yeah. As I was in my closet, ready to do that, I started thinking about a whole bunch of different things. And I went back to an incident where dad had shot himself and his kids were the first ones in the room. And they did everything they could to try to save him. They couldn't do anything. Remembering that scene, those kids, the mom, and knowing that my kids would be in that closet looking for me right after school, finding me in that position, I couldn't do that to them. So I was stuck between a rock and a hard place. So I wanted to die so bad, but then I couldn't do that to them. So I had to figure out a way to make it work.
What was the first step in your road to recovery?
Yeah, the first step was actually telling my wife that I wanted to end it. Mm. We got in a big argument, and I told her. And I went to Costco, and then I had a therapist at that time. She called me. He's like, hey, we need to talk. So I was like, yeah, I did that. And then I walked myself into Community North.
We always wow. hear about the importance of telling someone your story, finding someone to talk to. Did that help you? Once you decided to finally talk about it, did that feel like it helped?
It does help. Since 2018, when I came back to working on the road, I decided at that point that I was going to tell everybody everything. Try to do at least once a day to somebody new. And I haven't missed a beat since. And part of my recovery came from a conversation with a stranger.
What was that conversation like?
So I was working at a body shop, and this guy came in and lived on the west side of Carmel. And I told my story, and he's like, Brian, I want to pay for you to go do neurofeedback. I was like, I don't know what neurofeedback is, but if my therapist says it's okay, I'll go do it. So this conversation led me to Gray Matters of Carmel and starting the neurofeedback brain training sessions. And it was rough for a little bit. It's like peeling back the onion. But as I followed the program and I got more time, more chair time, I got better and better to the point where now I hardly ever go. I don't have I'm on zero medications. I have zero PTSD symptoms. I hardly ever see my therapist. I only do my maintenance for Gray Matters. And I feel great.
So for those not familiar with this company, this group, Gray Matters, what exactly do they specialize in?
They specialize in anything that involves a brain. They can kind of help fix concussions, PTSD, depression, anxiety, ADHDs.
What did you learn about yourself from them?
That my brain was pretty damaged. Years of police work, and I had a concussion. My brain was going so fast, it just wasn't working correctly, and this corrected it. You can see that through a brain map.
You know, I'm sure there's police officers listening right now that have been through exactly what you went through and have walked into some grisly crime scenes. I couldn't imagine. You know, your first thoughts are with the victims and the families. But, boy, there's first responders. There's guys in your position, police officers, that have to look at some pretty awful things. And I couldn't imagine what that's like going through that. And there has to be a better way. There's got to be protocols within police departments to facilitate your mental health and making sure that you're okay. And it just sounds like in this certain case, it didn't happen with you in the department.
It did and it didn't. The biggest thing is that it needs to be accepted that there are people, there are officers and first responders that are going to have things that go on. And it needs to be accepted that we need help, you know, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. I worried about losing my job. You know, and backlash,
yeah.
You know, and it's not anything that I did on my own. I mean, this is all 100% job related. I had no control over it. And it resulted in all these things I had just talked about.
Do you still have bad days?
No.
Good.
No.
Good for you.
I mean, typical life stuff. You
right.
know, married, kids, and
right.
that stuff will never go
Pacers
away.
Pacers get blown out on game one doesn't count as a bad no. day here, right?
No. And for instance, with the news today with the Indigo bus that was on fire, I heard it going across the news, Matt Baer talking about it this morning. That would have thrown me mm-hmm. into a flashback years ago just because your mind goes to fire, people, mm-hmm.
yes.
death. And that's everything that I relate to in my past.
And how's the relationship with your family?
It's a lot better. They understand. And that's a whole nother topic there. As I get better, they're still dealing with stuff. They dealt with me for years. with my own depression, PTSD, and I have a lot of resources that, just because of the position I was in.
Sure.
But there isn't much for them. You know, there needs to be more for them.
So if somebody's listening right now, whether they're a first responder, maybe they work with an ambulance unit, or they're a police officer, or anybody that would be at a grisly type of scene, and they're going through some of the things you've talked about, or they just don't feel themselves, what advice do you have for them?
Talk to somebody. Talk to somebody that you trust, and be honest. That's the biggest thing. Be vulnerable. I mean, who wants to go on the radio show and tell, yeah, you know, tell everybody that, what I just said? And it feels so much better when you do, and you'll get the help. You know, there's plenty of resources out there, and I can be reached. You know, I'll help anybody that I can.
Brian, thank you so much, one, for reaching out to this show, and two, for being as open and honest as you are. I know this stuff can't be easy to talk about, but the fact that you just did it on the biggest radio station in the state, the most listened to radio station in Afternoon Drive, that means a great deal to a lot of people. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hammer and Nigel presents. Is
it depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah. Is this anything?
All right, let's rock and roll.
Hammer, how do we play? Is this anything?
I'm going to run some stories by you. You break down all of the information and give us a verdict. Is the story anything or not?
Oh, ready?
Is this anything? A man in Canada was ticketed for driving his car with vice grips in place of the steering wheel. Here's a clip from YouTube of a guy showing another guy how it works.
How you drive? Turn the wheel. Turn the steering wheel. Let me see the steering wheel turn. God, what the? I've never seen no like that in my life.
Go to our X page right now. I just posted this. I just posted the picture. It's literally, there's no steering wheel. And the metal thing that's coming out of the middle is, it's got vice grips on it. And I admire whoever this guy in Canada that was ticketed for driving this car. I got to admire him. Maybe he had to get to work. Maybe he doesn't have enough money for a nice car. Maybe he doesn't have enough money to have a steering wheel on said car.
So you're justifying the guy driving with vice grips and pliers.
Look at that. That is human ingenuity at its finest. Boy, I've got to get to work. I'm missing a steering wheel. What do I do? I know I'll get some vice grips. I think that's incredible.
MacGyver himself wouldn't drive that car, right? And this guy is. Our X page, Twitter page, whatever you want to call it, at Hammer and Nigel. See the picture now for yourself. Are you on the side of Nigel, where you think this is American ingenuity?
Yeah.
Or at least Canadian?
Yeah.
And are you on the side of me that thinks this is re-damn-diculous and he deserves to get a ticket? Which side are you on? At Hammer and Nigel. Is this anything? The TMZ special. TMZ special with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone was on last night.
Oh, yeah.
They were asked if there was an action star Mount Rushmore, who would be the two stars that would round it out? Assuming Arnold and Sly are the first two, who would the other action stars on the Mount Rushmore be? Here's what they said.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
I would put Clint on it. Clint Eastwood was always my hero. My inspiration. He was one of those guys, just like Reg Park in bodybuilding, that spent time with me and talked to me. The fourth guy you have to come up with.
I think it goes to Bruce. See, he's a very multifaceted guy. He can do drama and comedy, whatever, and all the same. But he was in quite a few seminal action films. Like Die Hard's a classic, and those things don't go away.
I don't know. I think I'm putting Arnold, Sylvester. I'd put Bruce Willis up there, and then I'd do Tom Cruise
as an action star.
Yeah, man. Have you seen any of those Mission Impossible movies? They're incredible.
He's kind of morphed into an action guy because he was an action guy early on. But you're going to put Tom Cruise in over Clint Eastwood? I mean, that's tough, right? But I think I'm with the guys though on that one. That's a good list.
Is Steven Seagal in this conversation?
anybody we mentioned would kick Steven Seagal's backside.
I don't know.
Every single day of the week and twice on Sunday.
Jason Statham? Jean-Claude Van Damme! I look good.
Is this anything? There's an annual contest in Belgium.
Okay.
Where people try to do the best Seagal impression. A 9-year-old British kid named Cooper trending because he won the 18U group, the under 18 group, with his near perfect score doing an impression of a seagull. He also dressed up like a seagull. Take a listen.
That is bragging rights, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, we're all going to go around the room now and do our best seagull impression, right? I'll start.
Okay. Sounds like somebody ran over a dog.
That sounds like a walrus.
All right, I got number two.
That's actually better than mine.
Allison? So good. That is so good.
I hate you guys.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
It's the Hammer and Nigel show.
You're listening to the Hammer and Nigel show.
Hello, my name is Nigel. That's Hammer over there with a special guest on the hotline.
Adam Guyette is the president of Accuracy in Media, and he's had boots on the ground. He's been at Columbia this week where all of the protests are taking place.
It's kind of like ground zero for the anti-Semitic pro-Hamas protest is Columbia, New York.
Right. And he joins us now. Adam, how are you?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Hamas is definitely loving what happens at Columbia.
So take us through what you saw firsthand. You know, you spoke to students because there are some people trying to spin this as, well, what you're seeing isn't just the students. It's some bust-in bad actors. You were there firsthand. What did you see?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. I've been to that university many times in the past 6 months, and I've been to a lot of other universities as well. I think unquestionably, Columbia is the most anti-Semitic university in America. But this time, for the first time, I saw a lot of people there who were definitely not students. And what does it say about a university when tuition-paying students, they pay like 70 grand a year, are being told to leave the campus for their own safety while out-of-town agitators, adults, sneak on the campus left and right with impunity, no problem at all. It's clearly a university out of control.
And the university administration, what are they doing? How have they responded?
Great question. I saw a video allegedly of one of the administrators explaining tactics to use to get people onto campus who don't belong there. The administrator openly talked about, I think to a hidden camera, that if you slyly slide your ID card to somebody else after they swipe it, you could bring people in that way. That's what the administration is doing. You know, a day before I visited the campus last week, I was at the hearings in Washington on Wednesday when their president testified about how they're handling anti-Semitism. And she said they try to make it so that the protests are held away from classes so that people are able to learn without being disrupted. It was hard for me to hear her, though, because while she said that, her students were right outside the chambers screaming and shouting and demanding to be let in an overcrowded room. The irony was entirely lost on her, of course.
So, Adam, did you see students openly showing support for Hamas?
Yes. I hear them say death to Israel. I hear them say death to America. I hear them say all cops are you know what. It's important to understand that, yes, there are plenty of anti-Semites amongst them. But more than anything, these are just people who hate the West. They hate America. They hate Western civilization. And Israel just happens to be on the front lines of that fight. These are overeducated radicals who spent 13 years learning diversity, equity, inclusion garbage in our public schools. And it's for that reason that they want Israel off the face of the earth.
Yeah, I'm just wondering who, take the outside agitators out of the equation for a minute. Who is the prototypical anti-Israel protester we're looking for? Are they Americans? Are they, you know, are they rich? Are they, you know, do they even know what, do some of them even know what they're protesting?
Very few of them do, but you've really kind of got two factions. You've got the vehemently anti-Semitic, oftentimes international students who probably should be deported. And these are the people who, you know, send me emails every day saying things like they want to put a Hamas bullet through my head. Nearly every day I'm getting, you know, horrible messages like that from people. I'm getting comments on social media every hour saying vehemently anti-Semitic things. These are generally, from what I see anecdotally, foreign students who really just hate us Jews. Then you've got all of these LGBTQ for Hamas type people who would be thrown off of a building if they tried to have a Pride Month in Gaza. Yes. These are people who hate the West. They don't hate Jews per se. They hate Western civilization.
Adam Guyette is our guest. He's the president of Accuracy in Media. He's been at Columbia this week talking to students. You also had this mobile billboard and a couple U-Haul moving trucks there. What was that?
Well, we use a lot of mobile billboards as part of our anti-Semitism accountability project. For example, we find the names of the student leaders and we buy their domain names, like AmariButler.com, and we set up profile pages explaining their anti-Semitic actions. Then we work with search engine optimization experts, so if you Google them, ours are the first search results. Then we put their names, faces, and domains on the side of a mobile billboard, and it'll say things like, you know, Columbia's leading anti-Semite, and it plays the shame soundbite from Game of Thrones on a loop so that people can know who the anti-Semites are in their community. Last week, we sent our mobile billboard with "It's Moving Day" for the president of the of Columbia University. We sent that along with two U-Haul moving trucks to their president's presidential mansion because she needs to get the heck out of Dodge. It's time for her to resign. She is what is happening on their campus is out of control. She's got
to
go.
And what's the? I remember talking to you before about this a few months ago. Generally, you've had some response to putting people's faces up on those billboards. They've asked you to take them down and, like, kind of
walk it back.
Yeah,
they've
definitely walked it back.
Well, the responses run the gamut because we get people who say, just kidding, I totally don't hate the Jews. They're actually fine. I would like to have some gefilte fish right now. And we take them off of our billboards. We take down their mobile, their web pages. You know, some of them are probably insincere, but still I want to take them at their word. We believe in forgiveness. Other people respond to our mobile billboards with violence. They respond to me with violence, my cameraman with violence. They've bashed our mobile billboards with bricks. They've assaulted me. They've assaulted my cameraman. We now travel with security, and I haven't been spray painted since. They did try to shove me around a bit last week, but our security guys took care of that.
Adam, why is this happening so much predominantly at Ivy League schools on the East Coast? There's a lot of schools on the East Coast, and I'm sure that each university or college has a little faction of anti-Israel, anti-Jew agitators. I get that. But you're not seeing the big Chaz-like occupation at Rutgers like you're seeing at some of these Ivy League schools. Why is it the Ivy League schools?
I think the Ivy League schools get the most attention because they're the Ivies. You know, Harvard is a notable school, but Rutgers, oh my gosh, it is truly one of the most morally reprehensible schools in the country. I say this as somebody who actually grew up 15 minutes away from it in New Jersey. Perhaps the second worst university in America is Berkeley. And along with Berkeley Law, they are truly awful. They're the first campus we went after. In 2022, 12 student organizations there signed a proclamation banning anyone who supports the existence of the State of Israel from speaking at any of their meetings, regardless of the topics they're speaking about. You know, so they were anti-Semitic in higher ed before it was cool. Berkeley Law is truly bad. USC, where they have a special panel that selects the valedictorian based on interviews and other things, they chose a valedictorian who's openly been pro-Hamas and anti-Semitic. So the West Coast, they got plenty of anti-Semitism. You're not giving them enough credit.
And these people that are saying, you know, we want what happened in Israel to happen here with Hamas. I saw a clip of some, of course, she was wearing a mask, but she's saying she wants a Hamas-style attack here in the United States. And I'm thinking to myself, what exactly does she mean exactly what she says? Does she want the rape and the butchering and the killing of American citizens? Is that what they're openly calling for?
You know, it's hard to say, because when I ask them questions, they usually respond with expletives.
Yes.
We've started a new project recently where I visit anti-Semitic K-12 educators, and one of them was a gentleman named Ian Golash, who defended what happened on October 7th.
Oh,
he's the leader of the Ethnic Studies Department at his high school in Seattle. And I literally asked him that question. You know, I asked him, do you support what happened on October 7th? He said, yes. And I said, the rape and, you know, assault of women at a music festival? And he said, well, I don't like that, but I do support that kind of resistance. And I said, okay, would you like it if they came to America and did that at Bonnaroo or Lollapalooza? And he didn't think that that was a fair question. Precisely a fair question. That's exactly what happened out there. And that's exactly the kind of nonsense that these people want to bring to America.
Adam, last thing here before we let you go. We're watching all this unfold, and we're relying on cable news. We're relying on people like you posting things on social media. You have physically been there. The way that we're seeing it, is that a pretty fair representation of what's going on, or is it way worse based on what you've seen with your own eyes?
I think most of the coverage is pretty fair. I think when people talk about these situations being very violent, that's somewhat overstated. They probably would love to be engaging in violence. However, all the Jewish and Israeli kids got out of Dodge for their own safety, so they really haven't had the chance to engage in the sort of violence that some of them might want to do.
Were you able to see Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, today on the campus?
I did not see him. I hope for his sake that he had a lot more security than I bring.
It was a festive atmosphere, to say the least, Adam. If somebody's got questions about what you do, accuracy in media, where can they go?
Our website is aim.org, AIM.org. We're active on all of the social media platforms. We love tips, particularly of anti-Semitic educators that we should go visit and put a frown on their face.
Adam Guyette, president of Accuracy in Media. Adam, awesome stuff, man. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Hammer and Nigel Show.
Tickets to give away to the Grand Prix. Sancio IndyCar Grand Prix, May 11th, the road course at the Speedway. Josh was caller number 9. Josh, how the hell are you?
I'm doing great, fellas. Doing great. Love you guys.
Right on. Thanks, man. All right. We're going to play a little game called Andretti, Petty, or Famous for Spaghetti. I'm going to give you a fact about someone. It will either be a fact about racing icon Mario Andretti, rock and roll icon Tom Petty, or somebody that's famous for making spaghetti. You get 3 out of 5. We're going to give you these tickets, okay?
All right.
Number 1, Andretti, Petty, or Famous for Spaghetti sang American Girl.
Tom Petty.
Yes,
1 down. All right. Number 2, Andretti, Petty, or Famous for Spaghetti has won races in IndyCar, NASCAR, Sprint Cars, and Formula One.
Andretti, baby.
There we go.
Baby.
Get this right. We're going to throw a party. There'll be confetti. There'll be dancing girls in the whole nine. Andretti, Petty, or Famous for Spaghetti, Chef Boyardee.
I got an autistic son. That's his favorite. Whoa. Chef Boyardee.
Hey! 55!
Yeah.
You, Josh, are going to go check out the IndyCars on the road course May 11th.
Could you tell Allison I got my email address on me?
Oh, good. Okay. I'll tell you what we're going to do.
Allison, he's got his email address on him.
Thank you, Nigel. I'll take care of that.
Josh, I'll tell you what. Why don't you stay on hold and you and Allison can talk about all the email addresses you want, and we'll have another pair of tickets to give away tomorrow.
When is the last time you've had SpaghettiOs? Or anything having to do with Chef Boyardee?
Not that long ago.
Really?
Yes, because one of the lunches that I make in my meal prep sometimes will be like half a turkey sandwich and maybe like some SpaghettiOs or beefaroni, ravioli.
Interesting.
Calorie counted out a little bit. You can get a couple meals out of a can.
Okay, okay. Yeah, no, it's been since I was a kid. I have not had SpaghettiOs for decades.
SpaghettiOs are good, man. I love SpaghettiOs. Do not go anywhere. Abdul, he joins us next.
Hammer and Nigel.
Do you believe these characters are weirdos?
So let's rock!
My name is Nigel. Jason Hammer right over there, also joining us live in studio. Abdul Hakim Shabazz. He's an attorney. He's a show host. He is plenty a political pundit. He is, what else are you, Abdul?
That's a philosophical question.
Depends on who you ask, yeah. Right?
You did.
Ask Todd Rakiti, get one response. Ask Governor Holcomb, get another response.
You did us a favor. You watched the final Indiana gubernatorial debate, so yeah, we
watch it so you wouldn't have to.
Overall thoughts on what you saw last night during the final debate before the primary.
Well, how can I say this? This is going to be broadcast. It's going to be broadcast. Yeah. It was a total crap show. Let's put it that way. And I use crap instead of another word. But crap show.
Like, how is it different between the others?
It was horrible. It was basically everything that could go wrong in a debate. And I've been watching these debates for years. Could go wrong. John Schwanis, who's the moderator, lost control. The candidates were kind of arguing over each other. There was issues about the questions that were being asked. Mike Braun, wasn't there. So it was just a mess.
So earlier in the show, I made the comparison that this moderator last night was like when you see a bad referee in sports, right? You don't want to see the referee. You shouldn't know everything about the referee. He's not the story. Like when TV Ted Valentine or Angel Hernandez are calling a game, you know that these guys want to make themselves the story. I felt the moderator was like that last night.
I felt, and I've known John Schwanis for years, and John really seemed, he's done these debates before. I've done these debates forums before, and he seemed to be sort of off his game, because the number one rule as a moderator is you do not lose control of the stage of the forum. And if someone starts to get out of control, you forcefully but politely sort of remind them, hey, this is why we're here. It's not necessarily about you per se. You sort of do it in a very polite sort of way. But Schwanis lost control, like I said, and I thought he and Curtis Hill were actually going to get into a fight, because Curtis Hill luckily wanted to go and smack the crap out of him, because also, in addition to watch what people say, also watch their body language.
Right, because Schwanis, what's his name?
John Schwanis.
Schwanis seemed like he had to have the last zinger, not even the last word. He wanted to be the hot take guy last night, and when you're a moderator and there are so many people on the stage, it just feels like you shouldn't be making this about you.
Here's my thing as a moderator. You get one chance to be cute, or one chance to, to make a joke, but one is all you get, and one is all you should. Just maybe sort of lighten things up a little bit. But Schwanis didn't do that. And it seemed like he got out of order. There's issues with the microphone, and people were sort of riding the game. So when he called one person, it was supposed to be called another person. Their microphone wasn't up. It was just basically everything that could go wrong, in my opinion, actually did go wrong in that particular form of that debate.
Did any particular candidate stand out to you as a positive?
Well, they all stood out. But I would say if anybody stood out in that form, it was Suzanne Crouch. She stayed on point. On her talking points, axing the tax, which I have some issues with, but she stayed on her points, and she didn't let anything sort of distract her. Whereas with Curtis Hill, Brad Chambers, they kind of went back and forth. Jamie Rittenour was just Jamie Rittenour. I'll just leave that alone.
See, I thought Jamie Rittenour was pretty good at not putting up with the crap from the moderator.
I thought she was good at not putting up an answer, period. Because the answers she gave were not right; they're wrong. And if you understand the issues of what's going on out there, like, no, you can't do that. She wanted to get rid of the IEDC, like, really? So you want to get rid of $1 billion agency that brings economic development here?
I've heard her say that
right.
Before.
So, what are you going to replace it with?
But at the same time, if you're going to say that you think Suzanne Crouch did well, her ideas might be just as insane, like getting rid of all the income tax.
Well, my thing is this. From a performance perspective, Suzanne did well.
Okay.
Yeah. Content-wise, like I said, I got some issues with some of the things that she wanted to do, but I got some issues with a lot of the guys Well, dude, but from a performance perspective, I thought Suzanne stayed on point. I thought she did the best job out of everybody on stage there, followed by Eric Doden.
From a content perspective, then, when the moderator's asking, do you think Joe Biden is the elected president? What in the hell does that have to do with being the Indiana governor?
Absolutely nothing. Because the thing is, when you do the Indiana Debate Commission, they take questions from the audience. And so when I did this with Todd Rokita, Luke Messer, and Mike Braun back in 2018.
Because you've done this before.
Yeah, one of the things I did was I would look at the questions, sort of synthesize, here's some questions about the presidential election. Or I would make it about the presidential, I would make it about election integrity. Do you think Indiana's elections are safe, good, fair, based on what we saw in 2020? Yes, no. That's how you do that. You don't ask, hey, the Heritage Foundation report said blah, 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 blah. What do you think about the Heritage Foundation report? Well, none of these folks ever read the Heritage Foundation report, so that's not a fair question to ask the candidates.
Right. It was a lot of yes or no, answer it this way. And let's be honest, sometimes when you get asked a yes or no question, it requires a little follow-up.
Yes, exactly. It's one thing to ask a very simple, easy yes or no.
Do you like donuts?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, everybody likes donuts. Do you like sugar cream pie? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. But to say, on the intravitreal fertilization, do you believe killing embryos is abortion? Like, what the? Like, you can't answer yes or no. That's a more complicated. What the hell are you talking about?
So you thought Suzanne Crouch won last night?
I thought she'd fine from a performance perspective. I would say if there was a winner, I would say technically Mike Braun, since Mike Braun wasn't there.
Right.
And in the middle of all that. But then
he wins by virtue of not showing up, since it was such a train wreck.
Yeah, but then again, Mike Braun also has some other issues. Said he had to stay for a vote on the Ukraine and all the funding.
Yeah.
But did you really need to stay for that vote? Because the vote passed like 71 to like 28. So you're like one of the 28 people, so your no vote wouldn't have made
any difference.
A difference, yeah. Whatsoever.
But you know as well as I do, had he not stayed for the vote, they'd be beating him up for that.
I mean, like last time when he skipped the Senate debate for a fundraiser.
Right.
So it's six in one hand.
You're damned if you do.
So damned if you do, so damned if you don't. Yeah, exactly.
And pretty much right now we're looking at this is Mike Braun's to lose.
I think it still
point.
Is. Like I said, I looked at my polling, CBS4's polling, another poll. Mike Braun's been losing traction, but the undecideds really haven't moved yet, and I think it's technically still his to lose, because you don't need a majority to win a primary, you just need a plurality. So you could technically win with 21% of the vote if everybody else got 20. However, I think if you're an undecided voter and you watch that debate last night, become undecided, all they did was make you more undecided.
So where are we at with Lieutenant Governor? Because I know Micah Beckwith, he says that, you know what, let's take this to the convention. I want to be the Lieutenant Governor because I want to hold whoever it is, honestly. I want to make sure that they're doing their job, and if I have to give some pushback, I'll do that. That's not always how it works, though, in Indiana.
No. And the thing about Beckwith is, Lieutenant Governor is a constitutional office, but its functions are statutorily driven. So if you start getting out of control and getting ridiculous, the legislature can go and sort of take away, your ORCA, your rural development, your tourism.
How is it normally picked?
Usually what happens is the governor picks a candidate and says, hey, presents to the delegates, and usually it's just one candidate, like, hey, here's who I want to be my lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. And then the delegates usually go along and no one gets into an argument or a fight. This one may be a little bit different, because we could possibly have Micah Beckwith as lieutenant gubernatorial candidate, and maybe Dan Elliott, state treasurer, as a possible candidate as well, because Elliott has a conservative credentials, and he's not as bombastic as Beckwith is. But Elliott says, no, Abdul, I like being treasurer, want to stay treasurer, but it's always kind of nice to be asked.
Right.
So even though she wasn't going out with me, she asked me nonetheless. So
Abdul Hakim Shabazz with us. Sure. Radio host here at 93 WIBC, also the man behind Indy Politics. Any incumbents in trouble at a primary?
Not really, no. I mean, as far as primaries go, the 3rd District, which is Fort Wayne, kind of northeast Indiana, is open. The 5th District is open. I'm actually doing a forum for those guys this evening.
What are you hearing about Michael Young and Philip Clay?
Apparently Michael Young is actually concerned about Philip Clay. Because Michael Young put out a news release basically attacking Philip Clay and his whole 9 yards. And you usually don't attack your opponent unless you're worried about them or you saw some polling numbers somewhere. Now, I still think Mike is incumbent, and Mike has got a good chance of winning his district. But that's going to be one to look out for.
What about the Senate Pro Tem Rod Bray?
Rod's got that one.
He's got that one. Okay.
I met his opponent. He's an okay guy.
He's been in the studio with us before.
Yeah.
Jay Hart's been in here.
Yeah, but Jay Hart, Rod knows what he's doing. Rod's run before. Rod's been running like he's behind.
He knows how to raise our taxes. He knows what he's doing, Abdul.
Well,
you and all your butt sniffer friends.
Well, yeah, it's kind of curse running. Kind of the curse running the show, isn't it?
And then looking ahead to the general election, Rakita, that's probably his to lose, isn't it? He's gonna get the votes.
Not necessarily.
Really?
Because Todd is not well liked by a lot of people.
By
me, but also the more and more I talk to people around the state of Indiana, the more and more Todd Rakita has burned bridges. Now, please note, Rakita still has his 30% delegate floor, but still a lot of other undecided delegates. Now, Indiana is a Republican state, and Rakita is the odds-on favorite. However, you guys know as well as I do, in politics, anything can happen. And also, this is assuming, too, that Rakita can still serve as Attorney General because he's still got his whole disciplinary commission stuff that's out there as well.
So that's the Attorney General. Let's put a bow on this thing and assume it's Braun versus McCormick governor. I mean, not even a shot for Jennifer McCormick.
Well,
is it the Democrat?
Let me put it this way. I could walk back in my office and find $700 under my desk and all the crap under there. There's a possibility, but the probability is probably not going to happen.
Got it.
Okay.
Got it.
A
couple weeks away, are you going to be doing some stuff when the election results come out, Abdul?
Me, John Herrick, and Jim Merritt will be doing election night. Also, be doing some stuff with the Indianapolis Star, like a little bit earlier that evening with James Briggs, and the usual. Let's just get through May 8th.
Right.
That's all I want to do.
We'll get you back on the show closer to go time.
Hey, always good to be here, my friend.
Abdul Hakim Shabazz, thank you.
Are you really okay?
Are you okay?
Everything's
going to
be okay.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
I'm pretty far from okay.
Are you okay with this? On the Hammer and Nigel.
Oh, yeah.
So earlier today, Joe Biden read the part of the teleprompter that he wasn't supposed to read. Again, listen as he is trying to get the crowd to chant, 4 more years! But then he also says something after that.
Imagine what we can do next. 4 more years. Pause.
4 more years. Pause.
Allison, please play it.
Imagine what we can do next. 4 more years. Pause.
He read the word pause in the teleprompter.
I'm sure you're okay with this, aren't you?
I love it, because he's the real-life Ron Burgundy.
Damn it, who typed a question mark on the teleprompter? For the last time, anything you put on that prompter, he will read.
This is what he does all the time. Joe Biden will read whatever's on there, even if he's not supposed to. How many times has he done this before? You know what? Actually, let's take a trip down memory lane.
All right, here we go.
Let's do great moments in Joe Biden reading the directions for himself on the teleprompter history. How about end of quote?
You see, because there's new life-saving knowledge to be gained that must be used for progress of all people. End of quote.
That's so awful.
All right.
Quote.
I'll see the end of quote, and I will raise you and end of quote repeat the line.
Oh.
It is noteworthy that the percentage of women who registered to vote and cast a ballot is consistently higher than the percentage of the men who do so. End of quote. Repeat the line.
Great moments. Joe Biden reading the directions for himself on the teleprompter history.
Are you okay with this? Scott Weiland, who was the lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots, died of an OD in 2015. He has a son named Noah. Noah released a song called Time Will Tell with his dad's unreleased vocals on it. He didn't want it out there yet, but someone tried to blackmail him by threatening to leak it. So here's the hook of this song.
I knew you
with this?
Look, I'm all for a son trying to bond with his dad, but that sucks. That's awful. I can see why they didn't want this release, because it's a big hunk of poopy. No, this is never good. The only time like this has ever worked out is when Natalie Cole did Unforgettable with Nat King Cole's vocals in the background.
Sure.
But that was a song that her old man was known for. Like, it was released. It was out there. It wasn't some crap found in the back that nobody wanted released. So I appreciate the youngster wanting to have some sort of connection with his dead dad. This is bad, man. Not okay with this.
What do you think? One more, or we got to hit the news here, man?
Let's do one more.
Okay. The FTC has officially banned non-compete clauses, which stop workers from being able to seek employment at similar companies after leaving their jobs. Here is the FTC commissioner announcing the news.
The FTC has finalized a rule that will eliminate the vast majority of non-compete clauses in people's contracts. A non-compete clause is a provision that basically prevents people from taking a job with a competitor or starting a competing business, usually within a particular geographic area and for a certain period of time.
You okay with this?
Yes, I am, because this is something that is rampant in our industry, Nige. Not just radio, but broadcasting. Like, when your contract runs out and you want to go find another gig, or sometimes even if you get canned and you just want to go find another gig, you can't. You have to sit out a period of time, whatever's in your contract. That's no longer going to be the case. Now, I was talking with our boss in the back, so let's all relax a little bit right now.
There's nothing taking place overnight.
Right. This is going to be a 4-month process. So there's going to be about 120 days before this officially gets locked in. And then we will see if any business owners sue to keep the current system in place. And if one judge says that they can, and now we've got a little situation where you have to wait even longer. So I think it's a good thing. I think a lot of people are excited for it, but let's pump the brakes here.
It's the Hammer and Nigel Show. Hello, my name is Nigel. That's Hammer right over there with a special guest on the hotline.
He is the host of the Tony Kennett Cast, Monday through Friday, 7 o'clock, right here at 93 WIBC. Also an investigative reporter at the Daily Signal. Tony Kennett joins us. Tony, you used to work in the education field. You've talked about that quite a bit. It's kind of your bread and butter. So what are you thinking when you see all of these spoiled, rich, trust fund babies on these college campuses talking about how America's the worst place in the world and we have to free Palestine?
I feel justified because I've gone around for the last couple of years saying that it's these rich, progressive goobers who have nothing to do. They have no church that they invest their time in. They don't have like a family that they invest their time in. They don't have any really meaningful way that they truly sacrifice for their community. So what they've decided to do is find some random, weird conspiracy theory causes to get into so they feel like, you know, they've actually got some kind of purpose in living, because unlike the rest of us, they don't actually do anything that requires, you know, effort. So when I see the newest trend, which remember before it was that the white man is oppressing people of color, it was the white man is oppressing LGBTQ, now it's the Jews, ooh, and that's the new thing for rich kids to care about until they find a new prop to pretend to care about in another 15 minutes.
Well, you're right about not knowing what they're talking about half the time. I saw footage today of a reporter asking a protester and her girlfriend, why are you here? And the response was, and of course they were wearing masks, but the response was, I don't know, something with Israel. I wish I was more educated.
Again, this is the idea of the conspiracy theory. I don't mean conspiracy theory as like verifiable things, such as though the federal government intervened in trying to censor things on social media regarding the 2020 election. I mean like, well, have you ever noticed, and they always look around, that this certain demographic of people is in control of everything, and there's not actually any kind of data or evidence that supports there being some kind of secret cabal of white men or super Jews or whatever, but they show up on campus ready to protest because they believe that because they saw a tweet that, oh, there's a genocide of 1.3 billion Palestinians, that that somehow gives them the right to keep Jews off of campus. It's the weakest form of political involvement. It's pathetic.
But where are they getting this from? It's the professors, right?
It is. Again, and I made this point as well, that in the 1960s and 70s, there were these Marxist professors who came up with the idea that every single person is either an oppressor or the oppressed. And based on what you looked like and based on what religion you were either someone who was under the thumb of the big bad wolf or you were the big bad wolf yourself. And this Paulo Ferrerian idea, which eventually became DEI and critical race theory, has just bled into every aspect of politics, period. And I mean, goodness, even the president of Columbia University, 2 weeks after 9/11, was making excuses for terrorism on film. It's disgusting.
All right. So if you're telling me that these professors have a big hand in creating this monster, whose responsibility, whose job is it to cut the head off the snake and end this stuff? Is it the president of the university? Is it the president of the United States? Because I got to be honest, Tonus, I heard Joe Biden this past week basically say there's very fine people on both sides. It's not a real strong message of leadership.
I seem to remember that the last time in this country that individuals based on what quote unquote race or ethnicity they were not allowed on a college campus. I remember Eisenhower sending in the National Guard. So if we're talking about who can stop this today, Biden can send in the National Guard because students are being racially discriminated against in this country. And I go, well, it's a private university. I'm sorry. You do not have the right to bar Jewish students from entering an area that they have a right to be in based on their paying to go to that university. That ain't a thing. The university president obviously could end this tomorrow. I say that this is more of a consequence of past actions. Guys, this is what happens when you don't spank your kids. This is it. Wow. If you are a parent, don't actually set standards, this is what you get.
Tony Kennett with us, host of the Tony Kennett Cast. So while Joe Biden's kind of wishy-washy on what's happening on these college campuses, he was pretty damn strong in making sure that men can compete against women with his thoughts on Title IX.
It is something that makes my blood boil than anything else. When I was in Dallas, we did an episode on this because the idea that we would now require schools to allow any boy who just says he's a girl, that's the standard now. If one day you just say you're a girl, a staff member or a student who is a boy can go into a girl's locker room and sit there and just watch whatever they want. And if you complain about it, your school loses federal funding and will likely be investigated for violating Civil Rights Act. My God, we do not have dystopian novels that actually quantify how horrific that is for our young ladies.
How was he able to just go in and do that and change it?
Well, I mean, if you have these bureaucratic organizations, Nige, who Congress gave all of this power over your life as a member of the executive branch, they get to pass regulations. They're not laws. See, the DOE just passed this regulation. Yep. They changed something. And so then you're screwed.
Let's bring it close to home here. Update on a story we had last week, I believe, with you, an IPS school system having fight clubs in their classrooms, and it was all caught on video, and these were little kids. These were like 7, 8-year-olds, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And now the update is, did you see that? The Indy Star actually, you know, credit where credit is due. Indy Star had a great article about the update, is that IPS never informed the police about these fight clubs that were going on. They just handed it over to DCS, and they thought that was good enough.
Amazing how that happens, that after I made the case that, no, Superintendent Alicia Johnson does not care about children. They don't actually care about making sure that children at IPS are safe. They do not care about actually making sure that kids can learn in a safe environment. And it's all a big political game show for them. And this restorative justice, which again thinks that if you suspend a student, you're contributing to the student prison pipeline, or if you involve the police, that police are somehow going to give kids trauma. I'm sorry, if there's an assault on campus, you need to report it to police, because that's what the law is for, guys. It is not worth putting students at risk. But I mean, hey, I as much as I hate to say it, give me another coin for the Tony Kennett was right jar, because my God, I'm getting tired.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the video that was captured was from the teacher herself, and one of these students that was, again, around, you know, 7-8 years old with special needs.
All I can say is that filming students doing something illegal is in and of itself illegal. And also, I think it's like 4 different statutes in the state of Indiana were violated by that act alone. Now, if I was some kind of a lawyer at a school, let's say I was a lawyer at IPS, I would want to inform police so that I wasn't liable, because by not informing police, IPS is now liable for any and everything that a parent claims. So, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
So this may be a question that you don't know the answer to. I don't know. It might fall in the category of legal stuff. But when this gross story happened at Brownsburg, we knew who those teachers were. We saw photos of those teachers. They were plastered all over the news. How come that hasn't happened here?
Well, all I can tell you is that it seems in this situation that when you have a history of hushing things up, and credit where credit is due, these suburban schools really don't have a history of hushing stuff up. That's not how education has traditionally been done in the United States. But these inner city schools, however, that have been doing whatever they've wanted for the last 4, 5, 6, 7 decades. And by the way, I am not the only one saying this. There are very far left-leaning former teachers at IPS who have said the exact same thing. That district is used to covering stuff up. That is the most corrupt school district in the state of Indiana. And yes, I'm very well aware Gary exists. It is disgusting.
I think part of that Indy Star article, that update, was IPS allowed the teacher to resign. And there, since the police weren't involved, there were no charges filed. So we don't know who this person is. And they're allowed to keep their teaching license as well.
So the Department of Education, so let's shift to what can be done. Jenner can order an investigation. She can. She has the authority as the state superintendent under the Indiana State Constitution, as well as the laws currently on the book in the state, to order an investigation and reveal the identity of that teacher. If she doesn't, she should be canned immediately. That is one of the only useful jobs for a state superintendent with her kind of authority. Tell us who this nasty, disgusting creature is so they can face justice.
Tony, what are you going to be talking about tonight on your show, and what are you writing?
We have all kinds of exclusives from around the country in Fairfax, Virginia, where they're doing a drag musical for students. In Seattle, anti-Semitism. I mean, schools are just full of garbage. So I'm going to make fun of it on national radio because, you know, why not?
You can find him on social media at The Tonus, and check out the Tony Kennett cast tonight, 7 o'clock, right here on 93 WIBC. Tony, thank you, man.
Thanks for being the best, guys.
We were just talking about this next subject a couple of days ago. I couldn't believe the headline when I saw it. Lawmakers pushing to ban CLEAR users from skipping security lines in California airports.
Now, what's CLEAR?
So CLEAR, it's similar to TSA Pass. You pay a bunch of money every year. I think it's like $189 for CLEAR. And you get to basically skip the security lines. They have like an eye scan for you, so you don't have to show your identification or anything.
So it's like some James Bond stuff.
And so I do TSA pre-check. My wife travels a lot. She said, totally worth it. It's not as much as CLEAR. Mine was only like, you know, $50 to $80 or something like that. But because in the name of equity, they want to either ban or make it so more people can have access to it. To this
Why
service.
Equity? What's wrong with CLEAR?
Not everybody can afford it.
You got to be kidding me.
That's California right there. Look, I used
to. So we should ban mansions then, because not everybody can afford to live in one.
You start banning the fast. Do they still have a fast pass at Disneyland or Disney World?
I mean, they used to. I'm not sure if they do or not.
It's kind of the same thing. It's just, you know, the rich are skipping long lines, so ban it. And while we're at it,
yeah, ban the fast pass at Disney World or whatever it's called. It was worth every penny to me, the TSA checkpoint, because I just traveled recently in Arizona, and there were long lines headed out of the Indianapolis International Airport to go to Phoenix, to where the Waste Management Open was. I mean, tons and tons and tons of people, and I was able to get through just like that. But it's kind of a pain in the ass getting the paperwork done. You have to go to like a random place and sit for a couple of, like, the place I had to go to sign up for TSA pre-check was, I think it was Staples on Keystone.
Really?
And they,
when you think of security for our airlines, yeah, you think of Staples.
And so it's worth it, though. Totally.
But you also probably should do it with your spouse or your kids, because it sucks if just one person goes through.
That's the thing. The kids don't have to have it.
Okay.
If I was traveling with Lindsay and I didn't have it, I'd have to go through regular security. So adults have to have it, no matter if they're married or not, but the kids don't have to have it, and they're thinking about banning it, or, you know, at least making it more equitable for all the users in California.
That's the state governed by the guy that went to the fancy restaurant when he locked everybody down, right?
The French Laundry.
Yeah.
Yes. Everybody, nobody could, the restaurants were closed, nobody could go anywhere except for the governor and his rich medical executive friends.
It's the Hammer and Nigel Show.